Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a physics teacher who's full-time from year 8 through to year 13.
And physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time A-level, mostly teacher of physics. And how has your week been, Robin?
It's been busy, really busy. It's one of those crushing weeks you get towards the end of the term. We've had parents' evenings, reports due, goodness knows what. So it's just been absolutely frenetic. So apologies for the show notes being late last week. Oops.
Well, I don't think the world will end. Yes, I knew you were struggling, but here we are. We've managed to find a time. And I'm glad you're back in touch, because I had such fun this week teaching physics, and I wanted to tell you about it. And then it led to me having an idea for this week's episode. I'll tell you what I did, if you're interested.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Tell me.
So I remember from when I did A-level flame probe. And I've never done it, and I don't really remember what it was. So I set about using a search engine to find flame probe, and I found an amazing blog, Wigton Physics. Big shout out to Mr. B, who is anonymous on that blog, but wow, I wish we could get him on. But he had a very good description of how the flame probe works. And it's just a fantastic, fantastic demonstration, because it has 5,000 volts live bare metal. It has hypodermic needles on fire. It has gold. It's got it all going on, and it works fabulously. Have you ever done the flame probe?
No, never done that. Never done that. I remember doing something sort of similar with an A-level practical once, which was induction. What was the working out the resistance of a flame or something like that? It was a very sort of esoteric kind of A-level practical project thing. But so that's the closest I've come, I think.
Well, I shall run through it very quickly and then tell you what it made me think of. So the way it works is you have a balloon wrapped in tin foil, which you charge to plus 5,000 volts. So that's good. Very dangerous. In the middle of the room, don't want to touch that on the HT supply. Then you have a hypodermic syringe with a tiny flame. And I had to put a pinch valve on it. Didn't think that through. When I lit it, this jet of flame shot across the room. And that's a hypodermic syringe with a long rubber tube. And that's sort of elastic banded to a meter ruler. And then you clip a crocodile clip to the hypodermic, and you put the other end on a gold leaf electroscope, and you hold the flame near the 5,000 volt balloon without touching it, and the electroscope moves up and down as you'd expect. The flame, as I understand it, is to keep the tip of the needle neutral, so that all the gold leaf electroscope is the effect of the field that it's in. I may be wrong, and you're better at physics than me, so you can correct me there.
I would do if my brain was working, but it's not really very well, so it sounds feasible. I'd have to sort of look at
it. Sounds plausible. And what you're measuring, well, I put it to the class, is this measuring the field strength, or is it measuring the potential? And so that was a good way of looking at it, because one's proportional to 1 over r squared, and one's proportional to 1 over r. And we did the calculation, and we got the most beautiful straight line. Fantastic. On potential, which is the correct answer. And I put that on my personal Instagram, because I was so pleased. I like a straight line graph, although looking at it again, it did look like a bit of a curve, but the correlation was 0.98.
Pretty good correlation there. So that's fantastic. And this is a way to measure potential near to a static field with a flame, because anything to do with a flame is always better, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was super. And I'm going to do it again next week to find equipotentials. And what that made me think of, it, this was quite an exciting, thrilling demo. Lots going on, lots of danger. We had a big discussion about the danger beforehand. And I thought, we're coming up to the holidays. And I think a lot of teachers traditionally try and do something fun in the run-up to Christmas, in the festive season. As an atheist myself, I don't want to make this too religious.
The holiday season
will do. So I thought, what do other physics teachers do? And I put a tweet out to the dear listener to see what people do.
Isn't the listener fabulous? Don't they always come through?
The listener came through super fast, and we'll just run through the ideas, and maybe that will give the listeners an idea. To be fair, we have thought this every year, about a week too late, so that the episode would go out in January. So this year, the listener will have time to try and do this at Christmas if they have the parts.
Fantastic. So this is it. Your Christmas final lesson sorted. You don't have to stick Shrek on. You can actually do something physics-y. Fabulous. What a great idea.
It's funny. My daughter was saying, we were talking about films at Christmas. I'm a big no-no for me, films at the end of term. And she says, I've seen the first half of Ratatouille so many times. Can we watch the second half over Christmas?
Yes. It is this thing, yeah, because it's not even a very good thing to do because you only get half a movie in. So it's a complete rubbish thing to do. So, yes, do a physics demo instead. Why not?
Yeah, I've never understood it. And why would you put on the first half of the film? It's always a bit boring. And everyone's seen the film before. Put on the second half where it's exciting. Anyway, so let's run through what people said. And the first one, quick off the mark, almost immediately, was Christina Astin, at Christina Astin. And she just has this brilliant picture. And you think, oh, see, that's interesting. And you go, oh, now that is interesting. And what she's got is do you know Rainbow Fizz?
Rainbow Fizz, no.
That's a chemistry thing. It's where you have a measuring cylinder of something alkali, and you put a drop of consecrated sulfuric in it, and in universal indication, you stir it, and it fizzes, and you get a rainbow in the tube.
Right, yes, I think I've seen something similar, but yes, I didn't know it was called that.
Well, we call it Rainbow Fizz, and you have the longest stirring rod in the world. Anyway, Christina's done a density experiment, and she has got, if you look at the picture on Twitter, and we'll share it in the show notes, honey, corn syrup, fairy liquid, vegetable oil, paintbrush cleaner, and a mystery red liquid with no name. She may have to tell us what that is. And they're all different densities, and she has made a static rainbow fizz with all the different densities of liquid. Looks fabulous.
Superb. So it's layering the different densities of across on top of each other. Yes, I can see it there. She's got, fairy liquid and all sorts of bits and pieces. Yeah, brilliant.
And what do we think the misty red liquid is? It looks like it's in the middle. Could just be coloured water.
Could be, yeah. It could be just sort of red ink or something like that, Ribena. Who knows? Yeah, very good.
So I thought that's decorative and very good physics.
Yes.
Density.
Beautiful.
I like that.
I must take a bit of skill to get that. So that's a nice challenge for the students there to see if they can get their layers of colours as distinct as Christina's managed it there. Thank you, Christina. What a fantastic thing. That is brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, that might be a good practical. You could get them to make a three-way one, couldn't you?
Yeah, there's somebody we should definitely get on the podcast for that, Christina Astin, because I've met her before and she does loads of great stuff. So she's a good person to speak to.
And then also quick off the mark was friend of the podcast, Paul Planet Reynolds, who said, I love this, most exciting thing I get is centre of mass practical, but with Christmas shapes and decorations.
Yes.
So you cut out a Christmas tree and you dangle it from a string and do the centre of mass.
And why not? Well, that's a useful thing, because then when the students go home, they can advise their parents on how they should support their Christmas tree, because they'll know exactly where the centre of mass is from having done experiments in the lab.
Yes, and then Miss Bell at Miss B 0107. Says, I used to do this with Year 10, but they always chose non-Christmas shapes, and yes, they were almost always anatomical.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I'd never let them cut out the shapes. Certainly now I've heard what Miss Bell says, I'd never, ever, ever do that.
Absolutely, yes. Give them a nice Christmas tree and banish anything that even remotely looks like an aubergine. Absolutely, terrible.
Yes. I can see where your mind goes straight away.
Absolutely.
Now, there was quite a lot of discussion of something I had never heard of, which is using conductive dough or conductive putty, some recipes out there for making your own, to make a Christmas tree. So you have conductive dough or salt dough, and you make it into the shape you want. You just plug into it LEDs and connect it to a battery.
Wow.
And they light up.
That's very nice. That's similar to one that I've been doing, actually, because I'm in charge of the Year 8 STEM Club this year. So one we've been doing around Christmas is you need to spend our wee bit of money on this, but it's not incredibly expensive. So I've got a whole bunch of the kind of 2P-sized batteries, which you can get from Amazon for relatively little money. Again, it does rely on you, I'm sorry about this, because it does rely on you having a bit of budget. And so if you have some in the Science Club fund, you'll be spending about 20 quid's worth here, I suppose. You can get huge batches of coloured LEDs, again, from Amazon. I think I got 750 for about a tenner. And then also you can get, who knew this, copper conducting tape, which apparently you use to repel slugs. You put it around your flower pots and it stops slugs from climbing up into your plants. But who knew that? So it's mass produced and so therefore relatively cheap. But you can basically use it to make circuits on the back of a piece of paper. And then, so what I've done is printed out a whole bunch of like Christmas scenes. Kids are going to do a bit of colouring and then putting actual lights onto their drawings so they can take them home and they can stick the battery on the back with the tape and make a circuit and put the LEDs in between the positive and negative sides of their circuit and make some Christmas drawings with Christmas lights on them.
Excellent. Yeah, that tape, I think it's a myth it works to repel slugs. I think it's one of those things people buy. It looks nice. Doesn't. I think we tried it once. I mean, you just watch slugs crawl, slide across it.
Well, there you go. So pseudoscience that copper repels slugs, but real science. Copper does actually conduct electricity. So therefore it works for this application, which is good, but not necessarily. Yeah, apologies. We're not guaranteeing that it will repel your slugs in any way, shape or form.
No.
But it will keep you
Yeah, the conductive putty, quite a lot of people shared, and I've never heard of it before. Daisy Physics Fox at physicsfox_ed shares a recipe for making the dough, and I saw one, I can't find it now, where the dough was connected to some coins, and actually there was no battery, so there was even to put a basic cell in there that lit up the LED. You almost wouldn't believe it would work, and it did.
Yeah, so why not? I mean, that would be a lovely thing to do because you can make a few coloured lights flash on and off maybe with a homemade cell. So again, it's just an extension of the activity, isn't it? Very nice.
Yeah, super. And that dough just does look like a lot of fun. I think you're right. LEDs you can buy in bulk pretty cheaply now.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure we use something similar for that dough for resistivity experiments at A-level because obviously you can change the length and area very easily just by sort of stretching it out and squashing it up and things like that. You can watch the resistance change.
And I'm going to say a top tip from Daisy Physics Fox says, use a bit of blue food colouring to make the dough green. Green food colouring makes it look a bit like snot.
Thank you, Daisy. Brilliant.
And she also says the key is to have an insulating layer between the dough so each LED leg has its own side. That makes sense, doesn't it? If there's some secret physics going on in there so that the dough is in two layers, I guess, with a sheet of paper or something in between. Hadn't thought about that.
Yes, that makes sense. The other thing, of course, with these is the LED has to be the right way round to get it to work. So you do have to tell the kids that there is a right and a wrong way round to connect it. And if it doesn't work at first, try switching the legs round. From one side to the other.
Yeah, and that's a good learning point too. And the next thing was, I may pronounce this wrong, Boothos Gary, at Butch No Fingers, there's an interesting Twitter name, says there's an OCR A-level question about a satellite orbiting the Earth and whether it can cover or image the whole planet in a day. It takes photos of a strip 300 kilometres wide. Rework it for Santa delivering presents. I like that.
Yeah, to be honest, I've done that as an A-level question around Christmas before, just saying how fast would Santa have to go? They've got to do a lot of estimates and givens, you know, and things like this. And it's just an exercise in estimation of how fast Santa would have to go to be able to deliver the presents or not. And do you have to take into account a relativistic correction?
Yes, I think you do. I think it's like the travelling salesman problem, isn't it? It's an infinitely hard problem anyway to deliver presents to a billion people.
That's right, yeah. So they have to make all sorts of assumptions, and it's quite a nice way of leading them through these. You call them something once. What type of problems are they?
I think you mean Fermi problems, Robin. Fermi problems.
It's a Fermi problem. That's the one. There we go.
Open-ended, crazy questions.
Yes, exactly. That's about as open-ended and crazy as it gets. How fast would Santa really have to go?
And then thank you to Kerry Collier, at Kerry Collier, who just gives us a simple picture of a few party poppers and says, how much force is needed to pull different party poppers? Now, that is a simple question, but I can see a lot of mileage in that practical.
Yes, that is a nice one, isn't it? Yes, and because, of course, it will be one of those ones where it's a bit random for each different party popper and you'd have to take lots of repeats to make it work.
And lovely health and safety considerations. I always like them. I like things that are genuinely troublesome in the health and safety. You wouldn't want to have your face in the way of a party popper.
Well, you say that, but of course every Christmas when we have them, my brother gets drunk and then sets them off straight in my face. So there you go. Never mind risk assessments.
Well, I imagine they're pretty safe. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sold in packets of 10 and all over the country and you never hear of someone getting hurt by a party popper. But it sounds dangerous.
Exactly.
It sounds dangerous. It feels like it should be dangerous. Yeah.
Yes, and if anybody can injure somebody with it, it would be either someone in year 10 or my brother. 55 by the way.
But to be fair, if you could injure someone with a party popper, you'd hear of injuries with them all the time. So they must be actually unbelievably safe. So actually, I retract my statement about health and safety considerations. They must be the safest loud noises in existence.
Maybe Cleeps, are you there? Tell us, are party poppers safe to use in the lab? I don't know. They're going to be, oh, you would ask us that, wouldn't you?
Don't pop it next to someone's ear, I can think, would be
something. Be it. They're going to have to go, oh, now they're going to have to go and look at party poppers and work out. Oh, sorry, Cleves.
But I can see a lot of mileage in that, and you're right, there'll be a lot of uncertainty, but you could do it with any age of kid, and it's a nice, you could have class average, all sorts of stuff going on there. So thank you very much, Kerry.
Yeah, nice.
Now, did you see the one from John Hudson at johnhud845668861? Have you ever done this experiment, which is cornstarch on a speaker?
Yes.
Have you ever done that?
Yes, I have done that, and it is lovely. It crawls out of the speaker.
Yeah, I've never done it. Is there a trick? Is there, what sort of ratio do you use? I imagine there's recipes out there, but what should it look like before you turn on the speaker? Loose or...
So the ratio that I've done quite a bit with the cornstarch actually over the years, a number of times. It's 2:1 starch to water.
Okay.
So 2 parts starch by volume to 1 part water. And it's corn flour I've always used. So you can buy that in the supermarket in small quantities. We accidentally bought one when I think I asked for a 2 kilo pack, and we accidentally ordered a 25 kilo sack. One year, which is why I did quite a lot with cornstarch over the time, including the speaker. So it's very easy to do. Just cover your speaker with cling film, put it basically flat down on the table so that the speaker cone is upwards, put some cling film over it, and then you take a scoop of your oobleck, it's called, the non-Newtonian fluid that you make with cornstarch, a spoon of that into the middle, and then play some sounds through it. Start off with a signal generator so you just get solid tones and notes, and then it starts to do very strange things.
Well, I've never done oobleck, and I think that's something I love that tip about the cling film, and it's something I will definitely try. So you say 2:1 cornstarch to water.
2 parts cornstarch to 1 part water, pretty much foolproof, and that gets you a decent mixture, and it's amazing stuff. You can do all sorts of great experiments. Dip your fingers in it and then try and pull your fingers out really quickly, and you bring up the whole bowl with you. Which then startles you, and then you stop, and of course then it turns back to a liquid and it all falls off. So it's all rather good.
I've seen you can make a ball, you can roll a ball in your fingers and drop it on the floor and it shatters and then goes bloop.
Yes, that's right. Roll a ball in your finger, and then as soon as you stop rolling, it just goes to mush in your hands and falls out between your fingers. It's all very curious stuff, but it's wonderful. And the base of the physics is very, very simple. The science behind it is that it's basically like wet spaghetti when you drain it. And if you picked up wet spaghetti with a fork, if you picked it up, it would come up as a lump. But if you just held it there, of course, it would all just drip out and fall out. And that's basically exactly what's happening. The big polymer chains of starch in amongst the water act like a massive lump of spaghetti. So it behaves in that manner.
Well, I've never thought about that. I shall have to go and do some research. Now, the next person I'm looking at is Jackie Day at Jackie M. Day, who says Santa rockets using the IOP rocket launcher.
Brilliant.
Which is, I think, the standard bike pump and plastic tuber. And Christmas rocket cones from the internet. It's more smiling than thinking. Because I'd said, and you can see I nicked this from the Darwin Awards, I'd said a Christmas demo practical that makes kids smile and then think. So more smiling than thinking. I think you're allowed half of a lesson towards the end of term to make kids smile, aren't you?
Well, if you want to get them thinking, you can draw a speed time graph for the rocket, which is always quite entertaining to see, because the it only accelerates for as long as the water stays in it. So if it's one of those water rockets that you're using, although this one isn't. This is just the rocket cones, isn't it? The compressed air one.
You're ignoring air resistance there, Robin. I'm going to assert that it accelerates the entire time, just in different directions.
Oh, well, of course, yes. No, absolutely. Sorry. The thrust acceleration only lasts as long as the water remains in the rocket. So, and then, of course, it's accelerating due to gravity downwards. So it produces a curiously shaped graph, which is quite nice to get kids to think about. If you want them to do a bit more thinking than smiling, perhaps. if you're feeling like a bit of a humbug towards Christmas. Bob Cratchit, draw me a graph of velocity versus time for the rocket. Yeah, that's the way. That's Scrooge Christmas.
Bah, humbug. Talking of rockets, Ktror at Ktror, that's K-A-E-T-R-O-R, says, we tend to be finishing up space about now, and we work with the chemist a bit on bottle rockets, and shares a beautiful video of a methane rocket being lit in the dark.
Wow.
Pitch dark. So they black out the lab, and then there's this beautiful flame, which we'll share in the show notes.
Very nice.
And then David Cotton, friend of the podcast, at Newman Physics, says he likes to do the levitating ring, you know, the jumping ring. You know
yes. Yes, absolutely. It's great.
And he has a nice twist on it that I've not seen and I will use. Thank you for that, David. Where he puts one, he has two identical ones, and he puts one of the rings in dry ice, so it gets it down to, what, minus 30?
Yeah, something like that, isn't it? Yeah.
And it jumps that much higher because it's so much colder, its resistance is so much lower.
Absolutely. Very nice. What a lovely idea. And presumably, I mean, you can actually kind of possibly mug that up a little bit by having a ring that's slightly heated and one that's maybe even in the freezer. Maybe that's enough of a differential to do it. I don't know. We'd have to check.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a nice, fun... That's more make you think than festive, but it's such a nice demo. I always wheel it out at open evening, if we ever have them again. And what I do is we're lucky enough to have two clamp stands, one that's steel, one that's aluminium, and they look identical because it's chromed steel. And that's great because you can one works, one doesn't. And it confuses the kids. And then once they've worked out, because I put the ring on both sides, and it jumps on one, doesn't on the other. And I have the two coils in series so they can't claim it's the current. And then I palm the ring and I put a split ring on and then it doesn't jump on either. That's good fun.
Yeah, that's nice. Yes, the split ring is always a good one, isn't it, to do with that? I'd say one that I do that I used to do quite a lot, but this was back when I was a science teacher as opposed to a physics teacher, but I suppose in a squint you could say there's a little bit of physics in it, was my flame test Christmas trees, which I used to like. So you basically get a heat-proof mat, and you need some rock wool, which is that insulating wool that basically is completely and utterly flame-proof. And you would soak that in a little bit of methylated spirit alcohol. And then I'd put six of these in a Christmas tree pattern on a heatproof mat. And then sprinkle a little bit of different salts on each one. So potassium salt, potassium chloride, possibly sodium chloride. If you can get some strontium, that's a rather nice flame color. A couple more. Calcium's always a good one, isn't it? And put those on each different one of the rock wool bundles that I've put there, and then light each one, and you get a different color on each of the rock wool. And then they're going to take a picture of that, and that's their flame test Christmas tree. Now, I'm going to say that this was done quite a while ago, and you will have to check your risk assessments. Make sure with your chemist that you are happy to do that. Make sure your technicians are happy. Make sure it's all good, because there's a lot that can go wrong with this, and you have to be very, very careful not to over soak the rock wool and so on and so forth. So be careful with it, but it is quite a nice little demo to do.
Yeah, I think flame tests are always good value. I did them once as the taster day for year 7. So the year 6s came in and we did a taster day. Only two of them got a burn, which taught them a bit about health and safety in the lab, which made me happy.
And you see, when they talk to you afterwards, it's the two that got burned as opposed to the 28 that didn't. Always, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Yes, it's always. And, you know, it's only a minor burn. I mean, the worst you can get in, you know, this is with the little hoops of wire, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, you say, you warn them, and it's going to be red hot, and that's going to be really hot, and it will burn you instantly, and you must be careful. But, yeah, a couple of burns, but there are no parental complaints. They were very minor burns.
Exactly.
It was good fun.
I'd say the update I saw on those was using splints soaked in the salt solutions.
Oh, that's good.
Rather than the little loops. And then basically just if you leave the splints soaking in there for overnight, preferably, possibly even longer, I don't know, but you basically get them nice and impregnated. And then when you hold them in the flame, first of all, the splints don't catch fire very readily, very quickly. So you get the flame color very quickly. And then when the splint catches fire, obviously kids are a little more, when they see the flame creeping towards their hand, they're a little more ready to sort of shake it out and put it down before it causes an issue. So that was my update on flame tests.
That's very good. That's a very good tip.
That's quite nice.
Then the next one someone mentioned is you can add these Bernoulli demos to the list. This is Danelle Hogan, the STEMazing pro. We've heard from Danelle before. And she has shared a video of a very simple experiment using strips of paper, a spoon, an empty aluminium can, and two coffee mugs.
Nice.
And what happens is that you are able to move the can from one mug to another without touching it. So you put the can in a mug and use the Bernoulli principle to move the can from one mug to the next. Oh, my God. It's just that's such a surprise because I'm watching it with no sound whilst I'm talking to you, thinking, what is going to happen next? That's just brilliant. So I'll share a video of that. And well done. Thank you very, very much, Donnell. That's super.
That'll be nice. Very nice. Is that Bernoulli's principle? Isn't it just that the air is cushioning the cutout bit at the bottom of the can and it's sort of acting more like a kind of a...
Wouldn't it be making low pressure above the can and lifting it out? I don't know.
Well, so I think sort of isn't blowing into the cup, isn't that sort of pushing the air pressure slightly higher underneath than it is
on
the top?
I suppose that is Bernoulli's principle, isn't it?
Okay.
You've just literally described Bernoulli's principle, isn't it? The difference, pressure differential between the top and the bottom of a wing.
Okay. Fair enough.
So that's excellent. And then Ben Ford at Ben W. Ford says, we're doing the AQA engineering physics option after Christmas break. So next week we play with the gyroscopic effect with a bicycle wheel.
Oh, nice.
Both hanging for string and then sat on a stool, so to inspire them to do their own research. I like that. So, and then there's David Cotton says, oh, we have this. And so they have an inner tube filled with sand on the wheel, which is a brilliant idea. I've got so many bike wheels kicking around my garage and so many bits of old rubber that I don't need anymore. It would be very, very, very easy for me to fill an inner tube with sand and put it inside a wheel. And much better than my rather loosely wedged on Newton weights on the spokes.
Well, yes, except the Newton spokes are quite nice because it kind of show it's a visual representation of that. But the bike wheel with the sand in the inner tube will be ostensibly different, but the kids will have to explain why, won't they? Which is nice. So just two slightly different versions of the same thing there, I think, which is nice.
Yeah, I certainly got enough wheels kicking around my garage, but putting sand in is brilliant because my Newton weights are wedged on with elastic bands. I wouldn't say they're the securest; they do fall off a bit. So sand in the inner tube is ideal.
Mm.
Maybe water in the inner tube. Having taught engineering, and I'm doing it again this year, I didn't use that effect when I taught it in the AQA engineering module of AQA physics, but I think I will this year. It's not really on the spec, the gyroscopic effect, but certainly on the spec is the energy stored in the flywheel. I'm much more boring. I found a video of energy storage by the kinetic energy in the wheel in America, and they had this 5-10 gigawatt storage plant where they spun up these unbelievably big discs. And I got the kids to estimate from the data in the film, another Fermi problem for you, estimate from the data in the film how much energy was stored in one wheel.
Very nice.
I think playing with a big wheel, with the weighted wheel and the gyroscopic effect sounds a bit more fun.
Yes. I think it does, but yes, I take the point. It's a nice bit of engineering. I used to have an old single cylinder engine on an old boat we used to muck around on, and it was fabulous. A whacking great diesel single cylinder, and the flywheel used to carry it through the dead stroke of
the
cylinder. It was really nice. It was huge, great.
Yeah, that is on the spec actually. The there is a flywheel to even out the bangs. Mm. So you spin up a wheel on any engine you've only got irregular, you've got regular but with gaps bangs, so that if you don't have some sort of flywheel you have a very, very uneven power
yeah up. Well it usually doesn't work because it just stalls in the dead sort of stroke of the cylinder. But anyway, there was always a famous story of the person who hadn't used the correct torque setting to put their flywheel back on after they'd serviced the engine, and then it sort of flew out, rolled across, went out the hull and sunk the boat. So it's good fun.
I remember reading about a suggestion they'd use a flywheel-driven bus going down Oxford Street, and they had the maths of that. And I tell you, the flywheel was carbon fibre, so it was very strong and could go very fast. And I was just thinking, God, the speed that's rotating, the engineering to make sure it doesn't fly off and career down yes, Oxford exactly. Street. I mean, it was turning hundreds of meters a second on the outside of the wheel. I mean, it was spinning at some phenomenal rate just to get the bus between the stops. I'm thinking, it just slightly scares me. If someone drives into it and releases the wheel, God,
Yeah, or if the bolts shear because of metal fatigue over time, yeah, what's going
to
happen?
Well, I'm pretty sure they could engineer the bolts to hold it forever, but you cannot warrant someone crashing into it and changing the integrity and the energy stored in that thing.
Yes,
that scared me. But so, yeah, we haven't got any flywheel buses on Oxford Street yet, but maybe they'll come.
But who knows? Yeah, it's an environmental consideration, isn't it? That would be, interesting. Maybe they have to engineer them like the Boeing jet engines, you know, the ones that they have to do that test when they explode the engine, when they basically break loose one of the turbine blades and completely destroy the engine. But the casing has to hold whatever explosions happen inside, because otherwise, obviously, you know, in a real situation, you have hot bits of metal ripping through a fuselage, which is not a good idea, I think, in large-scale air travel.
I think that's frowned upon. I'll tell you something about those blades. When I was doing my degree, my master's, we went round the Rolls-Royce plant where they grow those, and they actually grow, as far as I remember, I may have misunderstood this time, but they're grown as one crystal.
Yes.
Because it's the only way to make them strong enough is one crystal of steel. And that's why the blades are so unbelievably expensive, and this guy had one on his desk.
Yeah, did you get the cooling story on them as well? Because that's a really nice one as well.
No, go on.
So when they make them, they have to cast, one of the reasons they're so difficult to make, and you can't cast them really, is they have to be cooled because the engine operation temperature is higher than the melting point of the material they're using. So they basically have to be bathed in a cushion of cooling, insulating air. So they have, if you look at them, they have tiny little holes all over it, and cool air is pumped from the outside in, and it envelops each of the individual turbine blades. And the Rolls-Royce engineer we were talking to said that it's the equivalent of trying to keep ice cream in a pizza oven. That's the kind of temperature differentials they're talking about. And they do it through really, really clever use of basically the cooling cushion of air that doesn't move because of the air's natural viscosity. So it's a fabulous piece of engineering.
I've never heard that the operating temperature of a jet engine is higher than the melting point of steel. Wow, that's blown my mind. Anyway, back to Christmas.
Yes,
back to the festive season, because we've been going on some time. The last one I want to mention is David Cotton again at Newman Physics, and he has a laser pointing at thermochromatic film, and the laser heated up slightly, and you can write on it "Merry Christmas." I think that's pretty cool.
Very nice. Yes. Oh yes, I'm looking at the video of that now. Very good.
So I think that's all the ideas we can get through in a timely manner, Robin. And hopefully someone out there can have some fun with them. I'm off to find a tin, a can, and a couple of mugs, and I'm going to try and blow it into the next mug. And I hope we've given the dear listener some ideas.
I hope we have. I hope they have a fabulous Christmas, fun Christmas. And this is the thing, you know, absolutely I agree with you about the whole thing about videos. You know, sticking on a movie is just such a cop-out of the last lesson of term. And this hopefully has given you some ammunition to do something a little bit more conscience-salving, but still a bit of fun for the students. So I hope you have a fabulous last Christmas lesson with your classes.
Here we are, Robin, third time's a charm. And the keen-eyed listener will have heard that your audio was a bit wobbly. I think we need a break, Robin. I think we need a break.
Yes, sorry for channeling my inner Davros there. I do apologise. Yeah, it was, lack of selection of the correct microphone, I should say, rather than the selection of the wrong microphone. I'd like to even pretend it was some sort of active choice. It wasn't. It was just me being a divot.
But it was also me forgetting to press record on another critical piece of software. So I think we need a holiday.
I think it is that time.
It is that time of year. So with those lovely holiday practicals, I hope they're useful to someone. We're going to wish you a very happy holiday.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, everyone. Have a fabulous time and a well-earned rest, and we'll catch you in the new year.
Yeah, we don't think anyone's going to listen to the podcast on the last Thursday of term, and we certainly need a break. We need to recharge and come back full of energy to do the podcast. I think I am only part-time, and I have found this term long and hard, longer and harder than the usual winter term.
Yeah, I mean, colleagues I've talked to, everybody's found it really, really punishing. And I think we're all saying, I was talking to one of my colleagues from English this morning, just saying he's on zombie time at the moment, just like autopilot, through the lessons. And dear listener, we do sympathise. We know where you're at. And I think you deserve a break. Have a lovely, lovely time.
Have a lovely, lovely holiday. And if you have any bright ideas for the podcast, contact us and tell us what we should cover. We know you know how to contact us, so we're not going to go through it. We'll rest your lovely ears. Have a wonderful break. And you too, Robin. You deserve it.
Take care, Thomas. Have a great one. See you soon.
Ooh, we made it. Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. And special thanks to all the listeners who gave us ideas on Twitter. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas WP, and Robin Griffiths, and produced and edited by me, Thomas WP, with Robin doing the show notes. It's been a long old term, and we're pretty exhausted, so we're going to have a month off and hope to be back full of energy in the new year. Have a great break and a happy new year.